Good evening. Apparently we have a video link and we are having to give it just another couple of minutes to make sure that everybody has got safely into the video link room. So just another couple of seconds. Of the noise ratio going up again, we will start. Otherwise, we'll have to come right back down to quieten. Good evening once again. I'm Christine Shinkin. I'm Professor of International Law here at the London School of Economics, and I'm also a member of the advisory board for the Centre of the Study for Human Rights at the London School of Economics. And it is my absolute great pleasure and privilege to be chairing this lecture this evening, and I'm delighted to welcome you all. LSE Packed House on behalf of the Centre for the Study of Human Rights. And the Centre is hosting this evening as part of its public outreach programme. Only very little short time ago, human rights seemed to be a given in the world. But as we are all only too aware today, human rights are now currently under a challenge. On the one hand, we have the widespread violations of civil, political, economic, social, cultural rights that continue in many parts of the world, often associated, but by no means exclusively associated, with armed conflict. On the other hand, the very language and values of human rights are too often asserted these days to be an indulgent luxury against a national security agenda, or perhaps even more insidiously, are appropriated as part of that national security agenda. There are heated, violent exchanges about conflicting human rights and about abuses of human rights and about abuse of human rights, as we are seeing at the moment, for example, in the controversy over the limits of freedom of expression and the right to religious respect. In a world in which now everything, human rights, international law, democracy, seems up for grabs, the need for an authoritative voice speaking out strongly for human rights seems ever more apparent. And I think it's against this backdrop that the decision of the 1993 World Conference on Human Rights in Vienna to recommend to the General Assembly the establishment of a High Commissioner for Human Rights seems ever more prescient. And of course, the General Assembly then took up that recommendation and established the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights as a department of the UN Secretariat with a mandate for preventing human rights violations, securing respect for all human rights, promoting international cooperation to protect human rights, coordinating related activities throughout the UN, and strengthening and streamlining the United Nations system in the field of human rights. A fairly small mandate, especially for an office to undertake. And at the head, of course, of the office, looking over and overseeing this entire mandate, is the High Commissioner of Human Rights. Now, 4 years ago now, at the time of the first activity of the Human Rights Centre under the current director, Professor Geerte, we were delighted to welcome Mary Robinson, who gave us a lecture on making reality out of the human rights promise. And tonight we are delighted and again honoured to welcome her successor, Louise Arbour, and in a sense, I think, to continue that same conversation and discussion about making sense of human rights. Louise Arbour, who is the current High Commissioner, UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, has been in that post since July 2004. Immediately before her appointment, she was a member of the Supreme Court of Canada, and her judicial career in Canada, first as a member of the High Court of Justice for the Supreme Court of Ontario, and then in the Court of Appeal of Ontario, was interrupted for the period that she spent as chief prosecutor for the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia and Rwanda. While at the Ad Hoc International Criminal Tribunals, she was, of course, responsible for the indictment of the former Yugoslav Serbian president, Milosevic, for war crimes, crimes against humanity, and, of course, many other people as well. Ms. Arbour not only brings her expertise as a judge and as a practicing lawyer to her current position, but also academic expertise as a former associate professor and associate dean at Osgoode Hall Law School, York University in Canada. Throughout academic and judicial career, she has written extensively in the areas of criminal procedure, criminal law, human rights and liberties, and gender issues. She's received the Doctorate of Laws Honoris Causa from York University, the University Medal from the University of Montreal, and until her appointment to the bench, she was a vice president of the Canadian Liberties Association. So, as I have said previously, we are delighted and very honoured to welcome you to the LSE to present a lecture on protecting human rights in an age of uncertainty. Thank you.
I thought I would, good evening everybody. I thought I would speak standing up, which greatly enhances the chances that I won't fall asleep while speaking. But on the other hand, from there, I can't see a thing, I can't see any of you. So I think you'll have to bear with me and let me just make sure that I get this equipment in the right place. Right. Last night, I gave a talk at Chatham House where I spoke about the responses of governments to terrorist activity and their implications for human rights. I spoke mainly about two issues that have led to considerable debate here in the UK, in Europe, and elsewhere. The first one is the alleged use of secret detention centers and of irregular transfers of persons suspected of terrorist activities, which would allow governments to detain them without any legal process and obtain information from them using interrogation methods that would be impermissible under national or international law. The second issue that I dealt with yesterday is a related issue, and that's the use of diplomatic assurances to justify the return and transfer of suspects to countries where they face a risk of torture. I postulated that the main differences between what some have described as the new normal, particularly post September 11, and the old normal, has to do both with the nature and the magnitude of the perceived threat posed by international terrorism, and it has also a lot to do with the response that some governments appear to be employing to address that threat, a response that is tainted by unprecedented secrecy, and, I say, a tendency to avoid judicial scrutiny. In looking at this issue overall, one must never lose sight of the legitimate expectations of the victims of terrorism. I think it's really important to set that out at the outset. They have a right to compensation, to justice, and to protection from further assaults. The roll call of terrorist victims has been a very heavy one, from New York to Bali to Baghdad to Beslan. No one who witnessed the destruction and the loss of life inflicted in this city last July can be in any doubt as to the nature of the challenge posed by terrorism.
Excuse me, can the mic be moved forward a little bit?
This one? Yeah? Maybe it's too high too. Is it? Maybe I'm too short. Let's try that again. Yeah? Please tell me if it's not picking up sufficiently. Now, the challenge, the seriousness of the challenge posed by the need to combat terrorism must therefore not be underestimated. And I stress that at the outset, because otherwise we can easily dismiss any concerns as not being grounded in reality. In fact, I think the most unique aspects of the challenge posed by current terrorist activity is that it calls for what traditional criminal law is least best equipped to address, and that is prevention of specific criminal activity. No one should be underestimating the critical obligation of governments to provide for the safety and security of all those who fall under their authority. In other words, governments have a responsibility to protect. Now, in that respect, I believe that responsibility is grounded in human rights law. Fundamental human rights are at stake, including the right to life, and the right to security. States, therefore, have the duty to secure these rights by putting in place effective measures to prevent and to deter the commission of acts of terrorism. Now, perhaps one of the greatest achievements of the World Summit last September in New York is the acceptance of this responsibility to protect, but in a different context. The seeds for protection were indeed planted in the outcome document of that World Summit that recognizes loud and clear the responsibility to protect populations from gross human rights violations. All 191 member states of the United Nations, a record number of which, actually 162, were represented at that summit by their head of state or government, and all of them, on a consensual basis, declared the following, and I quote, "Each individual state has the responsibility to protect its populations from genocide, war crimes, ethnic cleansing, and crimes against humanity. This responsibility entails the prevention of such crimes, including their incitement. We accept that responsibility, and we will act in accordance with it," end of quote. Now, that in itself is significant. Indeed, some might think it's even revolutionary as a commitment, particularly since by their very nature, most international crimes, certainly the ones enumerated in that document, are, as a general rule, perpetrated by state officials, or with their complicity, or through their willful blindness. Now, the next commitment made by the member states at the World Summit is therefore that much more critical, and I quote, "The international community, through the United Nations, also has the responsibility to use appropriate peaceful means to help protect populations from these crimes. In this context, we are prepared to take collective action in a timely and decisive manner through the Security Council in accordance with the Charter, including Chapter 7, should peaceful means be inadequate and should national authorities manifestly fail to protect their populations from genocide, war crimes, ethnic cleansing, and crimes against humanity," end of quote. Now, this indeed can be the seeds of a real revolution, both in law and in practice. Now, to date, the international response to major human rights crises has been mostly selective, ad hoc, improvised, and reactive. Now, I mentioned that the seeds have been planted because the question, I think, remains very much whether or not this commitment is mere rhetoric, or whether it actually, for the first time, will pave the way for concrete and coordinated action to protect threatened populations. But I want to postulate that our current understanding of life and human security is often very self-serving. Perhaps one of the greatest setbacks brought about by the reaction to international terrorism has been the reduction of our understanding of the right to life and to security to the immediate fear of criminal killings. And yet in today's world, it is not terrorism and its arbitrary killings that constitute the greatest threat to the right to life. Nor is it, as serious and heinous as they are, the four international crimes on which the responsibility to protect currently focuses. Extreme poverty, hunger, inequities in health and education, inequitable distribution of resources, and an absence or an erosion of justice and the rule of law generate more insecurity, lead to more instability, and endanger more lives. These attacks on the right to life are more invidious and target significantly different populations. Allow me today to firstly and briefly address the issue of how states respond to the threat of terrorism and how, in their legitimate attempt to protect the right to life, they need also to ensure that they do not infringe on other rights which form part of it and which give substance to it. And secondly, and mainly, I will discuss the embracing by the United Nations member states of the responsibility to protect populations from genocide, crimes against humanity, and war crimes. And I will argue that while this development is, of course, to be celebrated, it must also be understood and developed in its full potential for enhancing the protection of all human rights. Our understanding of the responsibility to protect must therefore go beyond the protection from these most serious international crimes. Our commitment to protecting human life will indeed continue to fall short until we develop a fuller appreciation, one which requires us to acknowledge and to act on a more holistic understanding of the right to life and the indivisibility of that right from all human rights. Now let me turn to counterterrorism and human rights issues. The various terrorism related resolutions adopted by the Security Council signal that states are under an international legal obligation to take strong action against terrorism. However, as also stressed in the Security Council Resolution 1456 of 2003, they must do so in conformity with their obligations under international law, including under international human rights law. Human rights law circumscribes states' responses to terrorism more directly, of course, than it prohibits the conduct of terrorists. Human rights law addresses states, while domestic, and in some cases international criminal law, addresses terrorists. As a result, arguments based on human rights may suffer from a rhetorical disadvantage, as they often appear to unduly impose on states one-sided constraints. They may appear to disadvantage states in their legitimate efforts to prevent and suppress terrorist crimes. In short, human rights law is easily portrayed as offering to trade the security of all for the liberty of a few. However, even though it may be painted as an obstacle to efficient law enforcement, in fact, support for human rights and the rule of law actually works to improve human security. A response to insecurity based on human rights is both more balanced and more rational, and it presents the singular advantage of dismantling rather than perpetrating the root causes of insecurity. As the Secretary General Kofi Annan put in his report in Larger Freedom, he said, and I quote, "It would be a mistake to treat human rights as though they were a trade-off to be made between human rights and such goals as security or development. Strategies based on the protection of human rights are vital for both our moral standing and the practical effectiveness of our actions." End of quote. So the centrality of human rights lies very much at the heart of the reform undertaken by the United Nations, as reflected again in the outcome document adopted at the World Summit last September in New York. Human rights is not a luxury that can be enjoyed after development and security are fully secured. Rather, it is a precondition to both, an antidote to irrational reactions triggered by fear that perpetuate both underdevelopment and insecurity. Human rights provides a framework for resolving dispute, even disputes that engage our most fundamental values and beliefs, and it provides a framework that relies on rationality, impartiality, and reason, rather than on force, intransigence, and intolerance. As the preamble of the Universal Declaration makes clear, only human rights protected by the rule of law will prevent individuals from being compelled to have recourse as a last resort to rebellion against tyranny and oppression. Contrary to a superficial understanding of human rights as individual self-interested pursuits, human rights are fundamentally a recognition of the rights of others. This is particularly so when fundamental human rights and freedoms are advanced by unpopular and vulnerable minorities to counteract the so-called tyranny of the majority. Ironically, when we are asked to decide how much of our liberty we are willing to surrender to increase our security, what we hear in reality is the following: how much of the liberty of others are we willing to sacrifice for our own security? How many of my compatriots am I willing to allow to be transferred to countries where they are likely to be tortured in order for me to feel safer? How many foreigners am I willing to allow to be detained indefinitely without charges if that's what it takes to make me feel secure? Obviously, we never hear what should be the real question. am I willing to subject myself to arbitrary detention or to the risk of torture so that my neighbors feel safe? The traditional paradigm that it is better to let 10 guilty persons go free than to punish one innocent has been put into question in the fight against terrorism. It's useful to compare the 10 to 1 metaphor and the following observation in a recent House of Lords decision, and I quote, "But unless one is willing to adopt a purist approach, saying that it's better that this country should be destroyed together with the ideals that it stands for, than that a single terrorist should be detained without due process, it seems to me inevitable that the judiciary must be willing to put an appropriate degree of trust in the willingness and capacity of ministers of parliament who are publicly accountable for their decisions to satisfy themselves about the integrity and professionalism of the security service." End of quote. Now, in my respectful view, this carries the fundamental misconception that a human rights approach, purist or otherwise, is adverse to security concerns. Human rights do not impede the protection of national security. They are, at least in democratic societies, at the heart of national identity. Consequently, in my view, a country is as much at risk, and so are the ideals that it stands for, by the collapse of its human rights norms and of the rule of law that stands as their guardian, than it is by the threat of terrorist action. The most profound insecurity does not emanate from foreign threats, but from internal temptations to let erode the foundations upon which national identity is built. This fear may not be as immediate and as palpable as that triggered by a bomb, but it's perhaps deeper. To fight insecurity within the framework of human rights is to fight with our strongest weapon, our deepest value. It's the protection of human security, in my view, in its most profound sense. This was put actually very eloquently by President Aaron Barak of the Israeli Supreme Court, and I'll quote. He says, "This is the fate of democracy, as not all means are acceptable to it, and not all methods employed by its enemies are open to it. Sometimes a democracy must fight with one hand tied behind its back. Nonetheless, it has the upper hand. Preserving the rule of law and recognition of individual liberties constitute an important component of our understanding of security. At the end of the day, they strengthen its spirit, and this strength allows it to overcome difficulties." End of quote. It has been argued in a paper prepared in the context of a broad research on security terrorism in the UK that was published by Chatham House, and I quote, "Social fears today have little to do with the actuality or even possibility of the presumed threats that confront us. Rather, they are often a reflection of social isolation, political cynicism, and mistrust. Hence, any purported solution must be conscious of the need to build up social bonds rather than undermining them." End of quote. An effective counterterrorism strategy will therefore address political frustration and social conditions that often translate into despair, exclusion, intolerance, and extremism of all sorts. It will address extreme poverty and ethnic and racial hatred, promote healthy civil societies and an independent press. It will avoid abusive methods to fight terrorism that generate new, angrier sympathizers who will then embrace a perceived ideal represented by terrorist actions and apologists for their despicable methods. A holistic understanding of the rights to life and to security will ensure that any attempt at protection will not create more security and more fear. It will promote social inclusion and encourage a serious dialogue in promotion of the values we stand for and with respect for the beliefs of those who differ. This means that a strategy to protect life and security will prevent criminalizing the legitimate exercise of rights and freedoms and will avoid discrimination, including in the techniques used to screen terrorist suspects. It will ensure fair trials and maintain the role of national courts in supervising national counterterrorism measures. It will provide for the full protection of vulnerable groups, including human rights defenders, non-citizens, and journalists. It will understand that torture and ill treatment and abusive deprivation of liberty are antithetical to any attempt to secure the right to life and the right to security, for central to those is the notion of human dignity. Now let me turn to the responsibility to protect. While states have strongly asserted their responsibility to protect populations from international terrorism and have acted on it, their commitment to the protection against other types of violations of the right to life has been at best limited and at worst very selective. One cannot ignore that even in the presence of blatant violations of human rights, there has often been no intervention to protect threatened populations. Such omissions render even more timely the recognition at the World Summit of the responsibility to protect all populations everywhere. Now, the significance of this development lies in the important reassertion at the highest level of the primary responsibility of national authorities for preventing international crimes, as well as the duty of the international community to take action to protect populations where national authorities fail, whether deliberately or by neglect. In essence, the concept of the responsibility to protect articulates a basis for intervention in the face of our continued tolerance for violations of the right to life, and it reminds national governments of their duty to prevent violations when they occur. Not only is it the first explicit acceptance by all member states of the concept of the responsibility to protect, but this responsibility, which includes an obligation to prevent, goes beyond the crime of genocide. Now, the Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide already creates for states party that obligation to prevent and to punish. But this extra obligation for genocide has often created unjustified hesitation on the parts of some states to call serious violations genocide for fear of triggering the obligation to intervene to protect targeted population. This politics of avoidance is very well documented in the inconceivable failure of the world to come to the rescue of Rwandans in the slaughter of 1994. Now, this uncomfortable obligation has now been extended to all member states and by all member states to other comparatively serious international crimes. Now, clearly, the prevention of gross violations of human rights should not be dependent on their characterization as genocide, which often can only be determined after a very sophisticated and time-consuming factual and legal analysis. In short, the debates as to the exact legal characterization of gross human rights violations should not impede the triggering of the responsibility to protect, which I reiterate includes the responsibility to prevent. For instance, whether or not there is technically a genocide in Darfur suddenly becomes less relevant, at least as far as our collective responsibility to protect the population of Darfur is concerned. At least one may hope that this is one less ambiguity. Regardless of a possible right of unilateral intervention for the protection of threatened population, what is clear is that most would prefer to see decisions on interventions taken collectively through the United Nations. If ambiguity remains as to the powers and indeed the responsibility of the Security Council to intervene in domestic affairs to protect the population from serious violations of human rights and of international humanitarian law, which would amount to international crimes, it has been significantly diminished, and one hopes perhaps extinguished, by the clear commitment recently made on that issue. Of course, at the end of the day, the reality will remain. When the Security Council is paralyzed by the threat or the use of the veto, or is otherwise unwilling or unable to act, the responsibility to protect, at least as far as the use of force is concerned, will remain a rhetorical, if not in fact, a very cynical commitment. Now, to this effect, I think it's important to mention that there is a secondary role that can be played by the General Assembly in this regard. And for the first time in a very long time, this was actually alluded to at the World Summit. Now, if we are to build on the window of opportunity afforded by the commitment to the responsibility to protect, we need to examine the risk inherent in a narrow interpretation of that concept and the shortcomings of our current approach. I would argue that focusing solely on the prevention of four international crimes, serious again as they are, reflects a deeply rooted, but in my view, a totally irrational distinction between the role of the state as the equal guarantor of the two fundamental freedoms articulated by Roosevelt as freedom from fear and freedom from want. It expresses also the privileged position of the international community as the protector through a robust Security Council of civil and political rights against a much more timid, consensual, and weaker system of protection for economic and social rights. Each year, about 530,000 women die in pregnancy or in childbirth, and more than 10 million children die before their fifth birthday. The UNDP suggests that this alarming trend is in fact approaching the point that merits declaration of an international health emergency. More than 1 billion people lack access to safe waters, and 2.6 billion lack access to improved sanitation. These factors contribute to the spread of disease, which kills an estimated 3,900 children every day. Worldwide, AIDS killed more than 3 million people last year alone. 25 million people are currently living with HIV in sub-Saharan Africa, and only 4% have access to the medicines that they need in order to survive. And of course, the vast majority of these deaths occur in developing countries, and crucially, most of them are avoidable. As long as the mobilization of a humanitarian response to the plight of so many remains a matter of charitable predisposition or a mere response to an unbearable embarrassment, human rights law will have fallen far short of its intended mark. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights makes no such distinction. We cannot conveniently shift from legal to mere moral responsibility when confronted with acts or omissions which equally imperil the lives of those who must rely on the state for their protection. At the World Summit, the member states stressed the need for the General Assembly to continue consideration of the responsibility to protect populations and its implications. I think it's crucial that a full understanding of prevention be fleshed out so as to include the protection of populations from violations of all their human rights, from the right to eat to the right to be free from torture. According to the most recent Human Development Report, the world's 500 richest individuals have a combined income greater than that of the poorest 416 million. A staggering 1.1 billion people live on less than a dollar a day. Those affected are amongst the most vulnerable to deterioration in their living conditions through poor nutrition, exclusion from education, housing, and justice, lack of adequate health care, and restriction on their privacy and personal security. Again, at the summit, member states also restated their recognition of the inextricable link between social and economic development, security, and human rights. That link was understood by the founders of the modern human rights movement and by the drafters of the Universal Declaration on Human Rights. The Declaration, and later the International Human Rights Treaty framework that it inspired, reflected an integrated vision of human rights as embodying all the interests and entitlements necessary for life with dignity, a life allowing the individual security, including freedom from want. While the founders of the international human rights law drafted the Universal Declaration with continual advancement of all rights in mind, we have in practice long lost sight of this imperative. even after the reaffirmation of the interdependence of all human rights, many of our strategies are still based on a unhelpful categorization of rights, civil and political on the one side, and economic, social, and cultural rights on the other. This categorization of rights has worked against implementation for too long. It has enabled the privileging of some rights over others, sometimes for reasons mostly of political expediency. It has focused attention on violations of single rights without sufficient analysis of the surrounding conditions leading to violations, fostering, for example, an understanding of the right to life in its civil and political context without much attention to economic and social dimensions. It has delayed or negated implementation of economic, social, and cultural rights, including reducing them sometimes to be viewed as second class, vague and voluntary goals requiring massive investments rather than as minimal standards for life in dignity. And it has also fostered the invidious perception that economic and social rights are luxury goods to be claimed and enjoyed only by societies that can afford them. And yet, discriminatory exclusion and inequitable distribution of wealth rests on the same prejudices and stereotypes that tolerate neglect, ill-treatment, marginalization, and even violence against certain groups. They are based on deeply rooted beliefs, explicit or not, that some are more deserving than others, more deserving of respect, of rewards, and of protection. Now, the intensity of these discriminatory assumptions varies, and the difference in intensity from mild indifference to outright hatred expresses itself in practices ranging from tolerance of police brutality and of social neglect to active participation in torture and the promotion of national and international policies actually known to imperil the lives of millions. I believe that we must now move beyond convenient categories of rights towards an understanding of human rights that focuses on people and their capacity to claim the totality of their rights. A broad-based culture of rights requires the development of integrated strategies beginning with a reconceptualization of human rights beyond the current entrenched categories. The responsibility to protect, if it is to be meaningful at all, requires us to move beyond these artificial divides. For a marked characteristic of virtually all communities living in extreme poverty is that they do not have access on equal terms to the institutions and services of government that give effect to human rights. This inequality of access, and in particular to justice, is often linked to discrimination on other grounds. Although commonly seen as an issue of economic and social rights, the experience of the poor is as likely to be marked by repression as by economic deprivation, and indeed the two are very much interlinked. Too often, severe inequalities in access to economic, social, and cultural rights also create the conditions for other serious human rights violations. We must examine the strengthening of state accountability, therefore, with respect to all rights. Unfortunately, the categorization of rights has for too long delayed state accountability in relation to social and economic rights. There's growing acceptance of justiciability of these rights in many countries, and accountability must be further strengthened so that states' responsibility to protect all rights starts to be implemented at the national level. Ladies and gentlemen, a few months ago, United Nations member states reaffirmed human rights, security, and development as the so-called three pillars of international order. They accepted a collective responsibility to protect populations from genocide, war crimes, ethnic cleansing, and crimes against humanity, and they recommitted to the Millennium Development Goals as a means of fighting poverty. The challenge is now to put political declarations of state responsibility to protect against violence and social and economic inequality into practice. While national governments have the primary responsibility to do so, the United Nations system has a critical role to play. I've already mentioned that there's a potential role for the General Assembly, both in fleshing out the scope and implications of their responsibility to protect. But more importantly, I think we have to put hope in the creation, the imminent, I hope, creation of a new Human Rights Council. This new Human Rights Council will have a responsibility for promoting universal respect for the protection of all human rights and fundamental freedoms for all, it says, without distinction of any kind. The Council will be empowered to address situations of violations of human rights, including gross and systematic violations, and to promote the mainstreaming of human rights throughout the UN system, or at least that's the direction given by heads of states at the summit. We could be only days away from the creation of this new Human Rights Council, which is set to replace the Commission on Human Rights with a stronger, more credible, more effective, and more highly placed intergovernmental human rights mechanism, one that should act as an instrument of early warning and monitoring the violations of a full range of rights. The new United Nations Peacebuilding Commission, established just a few months ago, should also play an important role as it takes up its functions to ensure a coherent and integrated approach to post-conflict peacebuilding and reconciliation. In addressing the needs of countries emerging from conflict, the Commission should ensure that the responsibility to protect is integral to all efforts aimed at recovery, reintegration, reconstruction, and sustainable development. In our relentless quest for security and for comfort, we must not lose sight of the centrality of human dignity and of the broad range of rights that give meaning to it. The fight against terrorism and the protection against other egregious violations of human rights will not succeed by the implementation of increasingly repressive measures. The legitimate attention we pay to the more obvious excesses may at times impair our sense of alertness to more subtle, invidious violations of fundamental human rights. There's no need to argue that economic, social, and cultural deprivations may be the root causes of terrorism. It is, in my view, entirely sufficient to state that our collective welfare and security rest upon our willingness to acknowledge the equal entitlement of others and to act accordingly. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed for that strong, authoritative reaffirmation of the interconnection and importance of all human rights. Ms. Arbour has agreed to take questions and engage in discussion on various issues. We've got just about 40 minutes to do that. We have the roving microphones. Could I please ask people to give their names and also to keep questions fairly brief and to the point so as to allow as many people as possible to be able to participate. And what we'll do is take three or four at a time, then hand back over to you, and then take another round. And I better say as well that because of the video link, we're going to have to repeat the questions so that they pick up on the microphone over there. So please don't think I'm just being over, emphatic when I just try to repeat the questions. Okay, so who would like to start? Here and then there.
Hi, Ian Byrne, Interrights and Essex University. Do you really believe that an intergovernmental global body can effectively protect human rights? And do you believe the United States should sit on such a body, given what you've told us this evening about Guantanamo Bay and also the United States' complete rejection of economic and social rights?
The question relates to the role of an intergovernmental organization in protecting human rights, and in particular the role of the United States on such a body, given such issues as Guantanamo Bay and the US rejection of economic, social, cultural rights. At the back, there.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Elizabeth Hayden-Jones. My question was actually very, very similar to that. But I can tweak it a little bit. basically, I'm curious to see have your opinion on how far the Human Rights Project, as it were, can go with the United States being such a typically rights-averse country, save the Carter administration and the Clinton administration. We haven't seen a huge development in how human rights are protected, let alone enforced, or somehow made justiciable. Further to that, I'm interested in the separation between development and human rights, and if you think that socioeconomic rights can actually ever be truly justiciable with that schism between how we actually categorize them, if it continues to exist.
Thank you. That was a follow-up question, in essence, relating to how far the Human Rights Project can go in light of the United States attitude, and then follow-up on the economic, social, cultural rights issue as well, relating to its justiciability and in connection with the right to development. I'll take one from upstairs, I think. Here first.
My name is Justin Fratterman. I'm a master's student in international relations. You spoke a lot about the responsibility to protect. I'm just wondering if you could speak a little bit about how the resulting right, duty, or norm of humanitarian intervention, how we can ensure that that's not used or abused by states seeking to pursue more realpolitical goals. Here I'm thinking of the use of the rhetoric of democracy, human rights by the United States in the recent intervention in Iraq. Thank you.
And that was picking up on the notion of the responsibility to protect, and in particular, how we can ensure that the concept of humanitarian intervention isn't abused and is not therefore used solely for the notions of protecting individuals. One more in this round? Yeah, okay, we'll take one more. Take one more in this round then and hand over.
John Morrison, Business Leaders Initiative on Human Rights. On the responsibility to protect, clearly nation states have the primary responsibility. There was, certainly 2 years ago, quite a discussion about the responsibilities of non-state actors to protect. And do you see that as a distraction, given current priorities, or do you see that as something that should be developed further?
Okay, picking up nicely on the responsibility to protect again, moving to the role of non-state actors. And the particular issue was whether looking at the responsibility of non-state actors to protect, whether this is a diversion or a completion, I suppose, of the issue.
All right, let me try to crawl back into the chain of interventions, and I hope I'll do justice to all the questions, even though some are interlinked. Can an intergovernmental institution or system be trusted as for the protection of human rights? And one of the specific questions was, should the United States sit on such a body? Let me say at the outset that I think we're all conscious of the limits that intergovernmental systems produce. Any political system carries with it, I think, the limitations of the kind of clashes of interest that are endemic in these kinds of institutions. But at the same time, I think the political judgment of other states as one contributor to the advancement of human rights is a very important one. I would be reluctant to suggest that it should be the sole forum in which the advancement of human rights is promoted. And in fact, if we could make the current system a little more robust and move better, I think we have a formula that should serve us well. That is, I hope it will become a considerably stronger office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, what I would view as the kind of the civil service, the international civil service of human rights protection, and then a strong Human Rights Council, the political body. And I think if one of the two at any part in history is weak, the other one can be better activated. So I believe at the end of the day that when it works, there's no substitute for the political judgment of a collection of member states, particularly when it comes to denunciation and the expression of disapproval vis-à-vis the conduct of some. Ultimately, of course, you might argue that without Chapter 7 coercive powers, it remains somewhat of a weak instrument, but I don't think it's totally impotent. Now, should the United States or any other state be disqualified from sitting on such a body on the basis, in part, of the fact that it has not ratified some important international instruments? My answer to that would be no. I believe that human rights work, by definition, requires inclusiveness. I have never been an advocate of the creation of a self-appointed club of the virtuous that would appropriate the right to put the rest of the world on trial. I don't think it works that way. I think we have to create a forum where, in a respectful way, but in a robust way, we can engage in challenging our most fundamental disagreement about our most fundamental values and ideas. And I think we must do that in an inclusive fashion. Now, exception that I would put to that is we cannot have members of the enterprise who are deliberately trying to undermine its very objectives. And frankly, I think if the Commission on Human Rights has fallen into hard times, not to call it the discredit that has been attributed to it, to a large extent, it's because of a perception that there was a perversion of the very nature of the enterprise, which is not the same thing as a serious, bona fide disagreement about the wisdom of taking some directions rather than others. And I think we need to create that kind of very pluralistic and very inclusive form. And there was another question related to the United States as to whether it is rights adverse. On this, I would say one has to take a very long view of history to situate an entire country and its population on the range of its commitment to fundamental freedoms, rights, and values. I come from the Canadian legal system in which, certainly when I was a law student, the inspiration for the promotion of civil liberties, non-discrimination, equality, and so on, came very much from American jurisprudence. Whether at any particular part in its history a democracy chooses to explore its values differently, I think does not, again, allow others to sit in judgment of its entire historical effort and contribution. I think it would be extremely short-sighted to dismiss the contribution that American jurists, poets, politicians, journalists, writers, have made to our understanding of our fundamental freedoms, our rights, aspirations, and in particular our sense of equality and integration. On the question of justiciability of economic, social, and cultural rights, I will have to concede we have a way to go. It's extremely difficult to persuade, particularly the developed world, that the economic marketplace is not enough to let the fulfillment of these rights be realized. I wrote a dissenting opinion in the Supreme Court of Canada when I was still there, in a court that I think by any standards is extremely progressive on human rights issues. It was pretty lonely on the question of whether there is a fundamental right to welfare, to social assistance. Now, the irony of it is there's not a government, I think, that could ever be elected in Canada. I doubt that there'd be one in many of the advanced Western democracies that could be elected if it was not prepared to assert its obligation to provide at least a minimum in the realm of social security. Now, different governments have different views about how generous the provisions would be, but essentially it's way beyond us, I think, historically, to reject altogether the necessity for governments to provide for the vulnerable, for those who cannot provide for themselves. And yet, we are not prepared to articulate that as a right that could be asserted, claimed, litigated. We continue to view that as, at best, an expression of our charitable predisposition, or as a political trade-off that we have to fight at election times. I'm doing my best in my current position to continue to advocate for the full recognition of economic and social rights as justiciable rights that can be asserted in courts and can engage the judiciary in the assessment of non-discriminatory practices and so on in the same way that they do for any other rights. And frankly, they have the same features. Concepts of reasonableness, resource limitations, these are all very familiar to adjudicators in a judicial system. But I will concede on this one, we're not there by a very long shot. Whether the responsibility to protect can serve as, and the notion of humanitarian intervention can serve as a very convenient pretext for the pursuit of other objectives through the use of force, I think the answer to that has to be in the creation of an appropriate forum to legitimize the exercise. Again, in the concept in the summit document, it is suggested that we should retain the ultimate authority of the Security Council. Now, in light of the, to some, very disappointing performance on the efforts to reform the Security Council to enhance its own legitimacy and credibility, as I mentioned, there are avenues to try to empower the General Assembly as the ultimate multilateral forum where the need for even military intervention could be debated. But at the end of the day, I believe that it has to be rooted not in unilateral action, precisely to avoid the danger of an inappropriate use of humanitarian intervention as a pretext for the pursuit of other objectives, but to ground that in collective action, broad-based, preferably very broad-based support for collective action. On the question of the human rights responsibility of non-state actors, I think there is the danger of diffusing the primary responsibility of states, and in the case of states that are weak to start with, a further weakening them by shifting the primary concept of the state as provider to those, for instance, multinational corporations who could be, in some circumstances, who have the capacity to be the primary duty bearers, but I'm not sure it's all that wise, in a sense, to privatize to that extent their responsibility for the discharge of fundamental human rights obligations. But having said that, I think apart from the danger of bypassing altogether extremely weak states, we need to explore more fully the degree of responsibility that non-state actors must bear, because I think that's another avenue in which we could make serious advances, particularly in economic and social rights.
Thank you. Where do we start? Over here. The microphone.
My name is Ling Di. I have a very specific question, two questions, simple questions. The first question is due to the economic and the trade reasons, many countries are turning a blind eye to the human rights issues in China, such as the persecution of Falun Gong practitioners, such as the human rights lawyer Gao Zhisheng's case in recently. How the UN take an action regarding urging countries to pay attention to the human rights issue in China? The second question is, China has the record of having most death penalty than any other country in the world. There are 100,000 Falun Gong practitioners behind the bar without a trial. Every year, UN's motion for condemning China has not been successfully debated due to the pressure from China. In this year's UN's conference, does UN have any plan to solve this issue this year? Thank you.
Thank you. That was essentially a question about human rights issues in China, in particular the use of the death penalty. Yeah? Wait for the microphone.
Stephen Jacobi, Fair Trials Abroad, EU organization. My question is really following on from the previous questioner. One of the big problems of micro human rights, that is the individual's right to take their grievance to the commission, has always been the lack of signature of the optional protocol allowing such individuals to take grievances against the state. And this has had horrendous consequences for criminal trials in places like Japan and India and some quite enlightened democracies that don't achieve the same standards. Is there going to be a drive on this?
Yeah, the question was about whether there will be a drive for further ratifications of the optional protocol to allow for individual petitions in various human rights treaties. I'll go back upstairs again.
Yes, hello. My name is Sebastian Jodoy. I'm an LLM student here. I'm just wondering, in terms of this idea of promoting socioeconomic rights, isn't there a danger there in terms of displacing accountability and you know, moving the idea that to move forward on these issues, you have to go through the courts, which is a very litigious, you know, very expensive process to go all the way to the Supreme Court of Canada. So just in terms of, and in the last 20 years, most of the important social policy questions in our country have been resolved by the Supreme Court, which I'm glad because most of the time it's been a decision I agreed with. But on the other hand, it kind of, you feel bad that, or it makes you feel, you worry that political leaders are not taking the, having the courage to make decisions on these issues. Instead, they're just depending on, I'll do what the court says, or I'll wait for the court to decide this issue, rather than saying, this is a human right, and I'm going to stand up for it.
Thank you. The question was about whether using courts to determine human rights issue in effect takes abdicates responsibility from the politicians as to the balance between political and judicial determination. At the back, are there?
My name is Isabella. I have a very short question. What do you think about situation in Chechnya, especially under the light of new NGO law in Russia? And is it possible to call it genocide or not? Thank you.
Okay, a question about the human rights situation in Chechnya, especially in light of the NGO legislation. It's probably has another wide-ranging set of questions. So.
All right. On the question dealing with human rights in China, I visited China last year. When was that? Last September, I think. And I have to say, first let me start with the proposition that in a country like China, even an extremely modest progress, in my view, will have repercussions, positive ones, on the lives of so many people that we should not walk away from an effort even to take modest steps in the right direction. And very much in that spirit, in my first visit to China, I signed a memorandum of understanding with the government of China in which the explicit project is to work towards the ratification of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. There's no question that China, if it ratified today without reservations, would be in non-compliance with that covenant in many respects. But there's also a very clear recognition of that fact and a willingness to move, to remove some of the obstacles that are, in the view of the Chinese authorities, removable, in particular, some of the activities or measures in the criminal justice system, the law enforcement system, the whole system of re-education through labor, for instance. So there's a willingness to engage in addressing some of these issues to move towards ratification of that really important international instrument. Now, we could not agree on setting a time frame within which this should be accomplished. I was trying to persuade the government of China to make the commitment to ratify by the Olympics in 2008. I was told that we should continue working and without fixing any particular time frame. And I have to say, in that context, I read, or someone told me, that a commentary had been put in a newspaper during the time of my visit, where a high-ranking Chinese official had been quoted as saying that he was very optimistic that China would abolish the death penalty this century. Which I wanted to take it as some encouragement that we're moving in the right direction, but I would have hoped that maybe in my lifetime might have been a more encouraging measure. On the question of the death penalty in China, I certainly engaged very vigorously with government officials who were certainly willing to listen. I encouraged the Chinese authorities, certainly as a first step, to bring clarity to the situation and publish reliable information rather than leave their own population to speculate about the number of people who are executed every year and in what circumstances and for what offenses and so on, so that at least there can start being, again, a public debate about the use and potential abuse of the death penalty for inappropriate offenses, and that we can have a statistical basis to verify whether there, as it tends to be the case everywhere, it's applied disproportionately to vulnerable parts of the population. And I should add also that this memorandum of understanding also allows us to work with the government of China on the implementation of the Committee on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. China is a party to that convention. It has reported. There have been some recommendations. So I'm very encouraged, I have to say, by the fact that we now have a framework within which to engage in a very directed set of human rights activities in China, and as I said, on the basis that even relatively modest progress can affect positively the lives of very many. Lack of optional protocol, individual petitions. Yeah. Well, this is a real dilemma. The current United Nations treaty body system, in my view, is in need of a very serious overhaul. And it has to be a very serious effort. On the one hand, I'm out there encouraging more states to ratify more international human rights instruments, including optional protocols that open up the possibility for individuals to petition these committees directly against their governments. On the other hand, the reality is that even if we increase the current rate of ratification or the number of these opportunities by, say, 20%, I think we would grind to a halt. I mean, there's not much point in having access to these mechanisms if they take 3 years to reach the case, and they take up country reports that are 5 years old and have virtually no follow-up capacity. So yes, I think we need to increase the capacity of individuals to bring petitions against states in that kind of international forum. But first, we should not raise expectations that currently we have no capacity, I think, to meet seriously. On the question of the judicial role and whether it in fact undermines the political process, I think that if there is supported reasonable access to courts for the vindication of fundamental rights, such as all fundamental human rights, and for redress against inequalities and discrimination, the fact that citizens will choose a judicial forum very often is a serious indictment of the political process. It's because they've lost their voices. They've lost the capacity in a particular environment to feel that they have a chance of being heard in the kind of rough and tumble of electoral politics. And I think in that context, a judicial forum provides a very different environment in which to engage on some issues where, in my view, the more traditional, vigorous, public, democratic debate doesn't leave a lot of room for rational discourse. As I said before, extremely vulnerable minorities, particularly those that don't have a broad-based support in public opinion, prisoners, for instance. Again, in the Supreme Court of Canada, I participated, well, both in my previous incarnation as an appellate court judge and then subsequently in the Supreme Court of Canada, I participated in decisions regarding the right to vote of prisoners. Now, left to the democratic forum, it's a very hard a case to make. Not a lot of sympathy. And in fact, the loss of the franchise ranges from, in certain states in the United States, it ranges from felons being disenfranchised for life to people losing their right to vote for certain offenses or while incarcerated. Now, for a rational examination of what democratic principles permit the exclusion of anyone otherwise subjected to the laws of a country, I think courts provide a forum that values and promotes rationality over emotion. It is respectful of even positions that are viewed as marginal or extreme or despicable in the eyes of others. And it provides, I think, a cool-headed environment, a public analysis, but in a very different way than it does in the political fray. So, not surprisingly, I'm a big champion of providing access to courts. Now, I think, again, it's an expensive way of vindicating entitlements, but I think for some particular societal debates, it has proven, where it's accessible, the forum of choice of those who feel that they cannot be heard or cannot be heard in a respectful and rational way anywhere else in society. As for Chechnya, I wish I could come back. I will be there next week. I am traveling to Russia on Sunday. I will actually be in Chechnya on Monday or Tuesday. I will, I think, then have be in a better position to reflect on the human rights situation on the ground. I'm afraid at this point I don't have enormous insight to offer. And of course, in Russia, I will meet as soon as I arrive with major national NGOs and will explore with them their sense of whether the restrictions appear to have been imposed on them, what kind of impediments it places on their functioning. So I will be somewhat more enlightened on this question when I come back. I don't think at this point I can say very much.
Are you happy with another round?
One last round? I'm happy.
Right. Okay. Michael, sorry.
My name is Alex Dukalski, MSc human rights student. You've called for a new thinking about human rights and security, and you mentioned reconciliation. I was hoping you could comment on what role the potential emergence or entrenchment of a right to truth, especially with regard to post-conflict situations, might play in that new conception.
Is that a right to truth?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So the question was, what role would a right to truth play in post-conflict reconstruction situations? At the back there.
Matt Davis from ATD Fourth World. I've got a question about UK. Over here. the new Labour approach to rights has been very much to equate it with responsibilities, the rights and responsibilities agenda. And my question is whether you think that's a good road to go down. I mean, thinking, for example, of, say, a lone parent who her right to social protection or his right to social protection is conditioned by their acceptance to look for work and actually take up work, whereas the parent might say, well, my responsibility is to my child. So is the rights and responsibilities route a sensible way to proceed?
So a question about rights and responsibilities, and is the balance between them a sensible way to proceed in looking at the human rights agenda? So many hands.
Hello, Zara Afshar, studying LLM at LSE. I would like to advance the premise that part of the uncertainty emanates from the lack of cultural legitimacy of human rights by the individual subjects themselves, and ask how the international human rights regime seeks to address this lack of cultural legitimacy, bearing in mind the essentially contested nature of human rights and competing claims such as the freedom of expression versus the freedom of religion.
So a question about the cultural legitimacy of human rights and competing claims.
Okay. Thank you. I'd like to thank you very much indeed for stressing social and economic rights and putting them on a par with the civil and political rights, because as even the questions just now have shown, this doesn't happen often enough in my opinion, and I'm really, my sympathies lie with the largest number of the most severely deprived people in our world. The US has been mentioned several times, could I just briefly mention China and India? I know we've talked about China, but it's a very strong perception in the West, especially in this country, that there's a serious lack of human rights in China, where India is seen to have democracy and at least in theory the rule of law, though of course corrupt and brutal police activities and great huge delays in justice exist. But on the other hand, India has probably at least twice as much people in absolute poverty and severe deprivation from health, sanitation, and also illiteracy. So my question is this too idealistic, or could you foresee some kind of scale of global targets and judgments, maybe a point system, on a country as a whole, giving full recognition to social and economic rights as well as the political rights, so that we can look around the world and see fairly what's happening to the people in those countries?
So it's really a question about indicators with respect to human rights compliance, particularly economic, social, cultural rights, using India as an example. I think we had better make that last. So over, yes, I think so. Over to you to address again another very wide sweeping.
Yeah, and I have to say, it's extremely difficult to do justice to the kinds of questions that you're putting on the table in a few minutes of response. I hope nothing I say seems dismissive or flippant. These are very difficult questions, each one of which I'm sure could be the subject of your doctoral or master thesis, which I encourage you, of course, to continue to publish for our benefit. Now, the question of the right to truth, I think, is a really interesting question. It situates itself, I think, in the broad range of transitional justice-type initiatives that we're searching for. At the end of the day, it's linked also, I should make that point at the outset, it's linked to a question that troubles me now, which is the right to know now, the freedom of information, in order to have a healthy democratic debate about the initiatives that are taken by our governments in our name and on our behalf. And after the fact, I think the right to know goes to the roots, I think, of not only of reconciliation, but of people understanding even their own identities and where they came from. But it has to be situated again on a range of options, and I certainly would not want to think that it would displace mechanisms of accountability, particularly that it would not be used again as a pretext to bypass the promise that is held by the international criminal justice system that is just about starting to take root. So there's always a danger that when there's advocacy for an alternative, it's a convenient way of avoiding accountability, which I think should go hand in hand with the right to truth. The question of rights and responsibilities, I think in human rights terms, we serve ourselves well if we try not to introduce too much confusion between the classic human rights approach that divides duty bearers from rights holders, which does not mean that as a society we we cannot make choices to ask people to contribute to their own welfare or well-being. But I don't like to anchor that in some ideas that rights carry responsibilities. I think that's the wrong way to go about it. The right way to go about it is, of course, to say that rights are not absolute, that they are subject to appropriate limitations, that are reasonable in a free and democratic society, and therefore you cannot make unreasonable claims on the basis of rights. But I don't like the idea that there's a trade-off or that you cannot assert a right unless you're prepared to yield anything in exchange. I think that is very much a question of kind of social engineering or the engineering of social policies, but I think it's not all that helpful to introduce that, I think, in a human rights framework. On the question of the alleged lack of cultural legitimacy of human rights, it's actually quite interesting because the person who asked the question then moved on to the example of, for instance, those who would advance freedom of religion or those who would advance freedom of expression as, say, their dominant pursuit. Well, of course, all of these are anchored in human rights, and I think that we can certainly accommodate a range of cultural diversity within a human rights framework, and yet at the same time, I think, standing firm on practices that cannot be justified on the basis of culture, religion, or anything else, if they are, for instance, an attack, a fundamental attack on human dignity. So I believe that there's plenty of room to engage in a culturally sensitive understanding and application of human rights law, but that, and all these are rooted, I think, in international instruments that have enough broad-based acceptance that we should not, certainly I think we have to resist an assertion that human rights law is basically exclusively a Western concept. There are enough victims of violations of human rights outside the Western world who are calling on the protection of that system against their governments, that I think it would be abandoning them altogether to yield to the temptation to suggest that it's rooted purely in Western ideologies and that it has nothing to offer elsewhere. I don't think that's the case. As for the examples or the references to China and India, again, speak of cultural diversity, I think we have to admit to the magnitude of the challenge of the actual implementation of human rights in countries where the magnitude of demands are so disproportionate to anything that we may be used to dealing with. I have to point out, in the case of India, India is one of a handful of countries where there is actually justiciability of social and economic rights, and there have been pronouncements by the Supreme Court of India that were actually very encouraging and had a real impact. Interestingly enough, you often find that also in Colombia, for instance, countries that are in the midst sometimes of very severe human rights crisis, or if not acute, like chronic human rights deprivation, and at the same time have opened up, at least at the higher levels of their judicial system, access to some redress. When it comes to measurements or indicators, I think we have a long way to go. We have a very unsophisticated way of measuring implementation of human rights. But the only thing I would say on that, if we get a Human Rights Council, one of the features that has been promoted by many, including me, is that the concept of universal, periodic universal review, that is, all countries should come up to be put under scrutiny by the Human Rights Council, all countries for all rights on a kind of rotation basis. And when we do so, in my view, the appropriate way of doing that kind of examination is to measure whether at any particular point a given country is in a state of regression, stagnation, or progress on all rights. What is invidious and has called for the application of double standards and so on is to compare countries that have not just different cultures, extremely different capacities at any given time in their history. And so to hold countries to their true capacities and measure whether they are progressing or regressing, I think in some cases would yield to a lot of surprises and in some cases pretty harsh judgments on some that otherwise, compared to others, are likely to look reasonably good, but standing compared to their own records and potential, I think should be held to account. That's it.
And I'm afraid that really is going to have to be it. I apologise, there were far too many people who would all have liked to have asked questions. I thank those that did. And most of all, of course, I would like to thank Louise Arbour again for making... I don't need to say anything. I think the thanks of the whole audience are very clear of how grateful we are for you to come. And the last announcement of the evening is that there are drinks upstairs on the fifth floor in the senior common room, to which everybody is invited. And thank you all very much for coming.